Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, Cryptoconomy crew? Welcome back to the show. This is the Cryptoconomy Podcast, and I am Guy Swan, your host. And we are going to be going over, this is the week of defining of nodes and defining Bitcoin, of like what is validation, what is the idea of Bitcoin, and how does the network and the nodes, how does everything come together to make one cohesive thing? And one thing that I thought was very pertinent on this topic was this is a collection by David Harding. So he didn't actually come up with all of these. These are just things that have been known for a while and are discussed regularly and out and about, of errors in the white paper or things that are said in the white paper that are actually different in the actual implementation of Bitcoin, either because of changes that came later, changes that Satoshi actually implemented, or changes that were simply, as soon as Bitcoin was implemented, it just wasn't what it said it was in the white paper. Some of its terminology stuff, some of its actual implementation stuff, and then some of it is actual code changes to reflect what was actually true in the real world or the real network. So, and this is all on GitHub. And one thing to note here is that I'm actually using a completely new setup today. I have been kind of putting this off. I currently, with all of my setup right now, I've got my little Bitcoin cave here with, you know, draped over blankets and stuff so that it doesn't sound like I'm in my kitchen recording this. But basically, up until now, I have been completely tethered to my desktop. If I didn't have my desktop, if I'm not able to access this computer, if this computer went down, and it's a Hackintosh, so it is not, you know, the most reliable of machines. If I accidentally updated, I'd probably have an issue, and it might take me a day to work out what is going on. So, because of this, I wanted a mobile setup. Right now, I am attempting to get this done on an iPad Pro, which admittedly, software and stuff on the iPad, and then there's a lot of limitations with the iPad, but the iPad Pro is a beast of a machine. It is incredibly powerful, and at the same time, I just don't know if I can do the whole workflow on the iPad. I don't know how well this is going to work, so we're testing it out today. And it's going to require me to probably redo my intro and stuff. So there's a lot to be done here. If while you're listening to this, if you can think about, you know, how this sounds versus previous episodes, and kind of your thoughts on any criticisms, and hopefully I get this done very quickly, and this proves to be a really good mobile setup where I can just take it with me and record wherever I need to record. Because that's important. I want to be able to be productive anywhere and not be tethered to a single machine. So with that, let's go ahead and just jump right into this. This is posted on GitHub. This isn't actually going to be, it's listed as a quick read, but I'm actually just going to go through this point by point and then just talk about it. So this will be more of a deep dive and just kind of an open conversation as opposed to a strict read the whole thing and then commentate on it. So this is Bitcoin paper errata and details. Errata, like not erotic. errata and details. And this is posted on GitHub. And again, this is David Harding has collected all of this stuff into a GitHub page. And these are essentially errors or misinterpretations, bad terminology in the white paper. So a description of known problems in Satoshi Nakamoto's paper, Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system, as well as notes on terminology changes and how Bitcoin's implementation differs from that described in the paper. Abstract. Quote, This is every time I do quote, by the way, this is something that's pulled from the white paper. So, quote, the longest chain not only serves as proof of the sequence of events witnessed, but proof that it came from the largest pool of CPU power, end quote. Implementation detail. If each link in the chain, called blocks in Bitcoin, was built using the same amount of proof of work, the longest chain would be the one backed by the largest pool of computational power. However, Bitcoin was implemented in such a way that the amount of proof of work can vary between blocks. So it became important not to check for the longest chain, quote unquote, but rather the chain demonstrating the most proof of work. This is often shortened to the strongest chain. The change from checking for the longest chain to checking for the most work chain occurred in July of 2010, long after Bitcoin's initial release. So this was almost a year and almost a half. It was a little bit over, just a year and a half from the initial live, the Genesis block of Bitcoin. And whereas the original code was if the current height of the block received is greater than the quote-unquote best height, that's what the tag is in the code, but it just means that the new height of a block is higher than the height that is stored on the local chain, then accept it. Well, now it's chain work. So if the amount of proof of work on the chain received from the network is greater than the amount of proof of work on the chain stored locally, then that one is the new consensus. So a decent reason, like kind of an explanation of why, or maybe a demonstration of why this is important, is because Bitcoin Cash is actually a really great example. Because when they implemented the EDA, the emergency difficulty adjustment, and forked the chain, they had periods where blocks were coming in like 8 hour, 12 hour gaps. Like it would just take forever to produce a block, but then the EDA would kick in and everybody would dump hash power onto the network and they'd be producing blocks by the second. Like some of them were literally like every 5-10 seconds is new block, because it would significantly decrease. The way the EDA worked is it would it leaned far greater towards decreasing the hash power quickly as opposed to, decreasing the difficulty quickly as opposed to raising the difficulty quickly. So it just became way out of balance and people could game it. You could just pull your hash power from the network and wait for the EDA to kick in, and then suddenly you can produce blocks stupidly cheaply in comparison to Bitcoin. And because the price of Bitcoin Cash, Vcash, was higher at the time, it was wildly profitable to implement or to cause this huge imbalance on the chain. But what happened is that the Bcash chain ended up way, way longer than Bitcoin's in like no time at all. So in a period of like just a couple of months, for the short time that I think it was like 2 months or something like that, that the EDA actually was on the Bcash network, this was a consistent problem. In fact, miners actually got better at taking advantage of exploiting this bug in the difficulty adjustment over time. So it actually worsened as opposed to stabilizing. And during that time, I think they got like 5,000 or something. I can't remember exactly. I have the actual numbers in my article, How Many Forks Does It Take to Get to the Center of Satoshi's Vision? I talk about exactly how far of a head start Bcash got. But because of that, like Bcash has a much larger block height. It's like 5,000, 6,000 ahead of Bitcoin. Again, that number might be a little bit wrong. But it has many more blocks than Bitcoin does. So obviously, Bcash is not the higher hash power chain, even though it's got a higher block height. Now, there's a whole different thing of like Bcash wouldn't even be in the running because they completely changed the consensus rules. So like a normal fully validating node would not even see the Bcash chain. So that doesn't really matter. But it still is just a demonstration of the fact that the block height is not, does not correspond with the most proof of work, and the most proof of work is the one that is consensus. So just a good example that how, depending on the difficulty adjustment and the fact that it's constantly, that hash power is constantly leaving and or coming onto the network, that you cannot judge the block height alone and think that you have found the chain with the most proof of work. Okay, so next, terminology change. General CPUs were used to generate the proof of work for the earliest Bitcoin blocks, but proof of work generation today is mostly performed by special application-specific integrated circuits, or ASICs. So instead of saying CPU power, quote, it is perhaps more correct to say computational power, or simply hash rate for the hashing used in generating the proof of work, which is not, that's not a huge change, but it is an important clarification. All right, now quote from the white paper. As long as a majority of CPU power, in this instance we should be changing this to hash rate or hash power, is controlled by nodes that are not cooperating to attack the network, they will generate the longest chain and outpace attackers, end quote. Terminology change. The term, quote, nodes today is used to refer to full validation nodes, which are programs that enforce all of the rules of the system. Programs and hardware that extend the chain today are called miners, based on Nakamoto's analogy to gold miners in section 6 of the paper. Nakamoto expected all miners to be nodes, but the software he released did not require all nodes to be miners. Today, it is the case that the overwhelming number of nodes are not miners, and that many individuals who own mining hardware do not use it with their own nodes. And even those that do often mine for short periods of time on top of newly discovered blocks without ensuring their node considers the new block valid. The early parts of the paper where, quote, nodes is mostly used without modification refer to mining using a full validation node. The later parts of the paper, which refer to, quote, network nodes, is mainly about what nodes can do even if they aren't mining. So this is an important distinction because it was in no time at all, nodes divorced from the concept that Satoshi had thought of them in. He assumed, or at least it was assumed in the writing, that pretty much all fully validating nodes were going to be miners, and their job would be mining. But in reality, is those jobs almost split entirely. Because there are tons of people who want to fully validate the network, but know that, you know, mining with the machine that they're validating on makes no economical sense. Like, it's just a huge cost, and they're not going to get anything back out of it. But they are able to validate the chain that they're following. They're able to know that they're following the one with the most proof of work, that nobody has cheated the consensus rules, and if somebody feeds them a block or a transaction or anything that does not fall within the consensus rules, anything that is invalid, that is a cheating of the system, or is trying to spend coins that this person does not actually have, then they reject it and they simply ignore. They're simply immediately, by default, evicting anyone who is not playing by the rules. And that's an incredibly important part of the system. So when it becomes uneconomical to actually mine to do that, and you get to a situation where miners are becoming more and more centralized and there are fewer people doing that, then the validation serves a critical check on miners just abusing their position, or the fact that only a handful of them could, quote-unquote, change the rules and essentially trick the network into following rules that they never agreed to. However, we have the exact opposite happening with miners. A great example is pooled miners, where thousands and thousands of individual miners with smaller machines will go to a mining pool, log in with their account, and then let someone else do the validation, or don't even validate at all. This is actually really common, that, like, people talk about how no, miners are the only legitimate validators, and proof of work is what decides which coin or proof of work is the one that decides what is actual Bitcoin. Well, that completely ignores the fact that most miners don't, or excuse me, I guess I don't know that most miners don't do this, but tons of miners do not run full nodes. You don't need to run a full node to produce hashes. In fact, all you need is the header of the previous block. All you need is the hash of the previous block. You don't even have to download that full block or care whether it's valid. You're running a risk that you're building on a block that has a cheat, that has like a double spend, or is trying to spend coins that they don't have, or has changed the consensus rules. But for most miners, the risk is so low that they don't care. So, and that's the parenthetical that he has in this, is that even those that often do mine for short periods on top of a newly discovered block without actually deciding whether or not it's valid. So when they get a new header from a block that's being distributed across the network, they immediately stop mining on that, the one with that block height, and then start mining a new block. They don't check whether or not it's valid, because it's just it's excess computational power. And if the network accepts it, well, then they already know, okay, all these other people have validated the block, so I don't need to worry about that. I need to rush to get to the next block as fast as I possibly can, because this is a race, essentially. But that immediately calls attention to the fact that, like, who's doing the validation if the miners are not validating? Like, somebody has to keep this in check based on the consensus rules, and the miners might not even be interested. All they're doing is trying to make a profit margin off of computational power, and here's a market for computational power, for hashing, you know, doing a SHA-256 hash to extend the blockchain of Bitcoin or whatever other coin they're mining for, whatever's most profitable for the market. So if they're not validating, who the hell's validating? And that's why you have a network of nodes that will reject blocks from miners who either are lazy and don't even care about whether or not the block is valid, or are coordinating to try to change the rules on the network. Well, the network will simply reject their blocks and wait for someone else to produce a valid block. And so because of this, it's really important to make that distinction, because the net, like, for the tiniest period of time on the network, did nodes represent or actually follow the kind of logic that Satoshi had originally thought they would follow in the white paper? But in no time at all, because there was such an arms race for higher computational power and better machines, in no time at all, those two roles were essentially divorced. The miners really don't care about validation. They only really care is that they're compatible with the network, so that they can actually send it to an exchange and make their profit. You know, the miners are self-interested parties. They just care about making a return on their hash power, on their what they're contributing to the network. So that's a really important distinction, and one that we're going to be hitting far more in depth later on in the week. But even though that is a terminology change, I think it's important to kind of hit it at length. Okay, back to it. Post-publication discovery. When a new block is produced, the miner who produces that block can begin working on its SQL immediately, but all other miners must wait for that new block to propagate across the network to them. This gives miners who produce many blocks an edge over miners who produce fewer blocks, and this can be exploited in what's known as the selfish mining attack, to allow an attacker with around 30% of total network hash rate to make other miners less profitable, perhaps driving them into following the attacking miner's policy. So instead of saying, quote, a majority of CPU power is controlled by nodes that are not cooperating to, that are cooperating to attack, wait, quote, a majority of CPU power is controlled by nodes that are not cooperating to attack the network. Okay, so the line is as long as. So end quote. It is perhaps more correct to say, quote, as long as nodes cooperating to attack the network control less than about 30% of the network, end quote. Now, the selfish mining attack, this is actually another reason that we, another thing that's very important to the discussion of block size is a selfish miner is able to, like, if it takes, like, let's say we've got 128 megabyte blocks or something, as soon as there is any significant delay in downloading a block, like, it might take six, seven, nine hops for it to realistically reach every mining node on the network, unless they are part of, you know, some specific network or distribution network that is, you know, basically a permissioned network where all the miners get together and share blocks quickly, aside from just broadcasting openly across the whole Bitcoin network. So if miners are connecting to other miners, which is kind of another a point of attack, is if miners are only trusting other miners rather than the validation of the network. So it needs to be possible that anybody on the network, no matter where they are or which, you know, whether they choose to have some specific block propagation connection, that the delay between someone producing a block somewhere and them receiving a block is as short as possible. And that's why, even now, even with 1 megabyte, 2 megabyte blocks, 2.3 megabyte blocks with, you know, SegWit transactions, even now most miners will accept that next block with just a header, without validating anything, because there is a delay downloading 2 megabytes worth of data. And even if that delay is tiny, you know, if it gives a 1%, a 0.5% advantage, margins are so small in mining Bitcoin right now, and naturally will always be as small as they possibly can be. Like, that's just kind of how the market is going to push it, is if it's profitable, more people are going to want to join to mine until it's not profitable anymore. So since margins are going to be squeezed as tightly as possible, if you've got a 1% advantage in, like, when you produce a block, you can immediately start producing another, and you know all the other miners are going to take 6 seconds, 10 seconds of delay to get the block and then start mining, well, you get a head start. There's a great explanation, I think it was by Greg Maxwell, talking about how as soon as bandwidth is a limiting factor, mining becomes a race instead of a lottery. The idea of mining is supposed to be that everybody is buying lottery tickets, and the people who have more lottery tickets have a higher chance of winning, and the people who have fewer lottery tickets obviously have a lower chance of winning. But that does not mean, inevitably, somebody with fewer lottery tickets is going to win. It's just based on sheer probability. Just because you have a lot of lottery tickets doesn't mean you always win. If it's a race to get the block faster than the other person, and it gives you a significant advantage, like, imagine you've got 128 megabyte blocks and it takes a full 60 seconds, 1 minute out of 10 to download the block. Well, if you've got that advantage where you're just racing, you have a better bandwidth and speed of internet connection. In a race, the guy who is faster always wins. In a lottery, the one who has more tickets wins by the probability of their number of tickets. In a race, if you're 1% faster, you always win the race. So that's a really, really important distinction between in the decentralization of mining on the network, and why and how you make sure small miners are still consequential on the network. So if you've got 128 megabyte blocks and it takes you 60 seconds to download, well, during those 60 seconds, the big miners with the big data farms and the huge T1 connections, those guys who already have more lottery tickets now have a 10% advantage, 1/10 of the entire time between blocks, in a market where margins might be 1%, 2%, 3% tops. If you have a 10% advantage, everybody who doesn't have your internet connection, everybody less than you, is essentially pushed out from being profitable. So they're either just going to have to join your pool where, you know, you decide what blocks they mine, or you just inevitably have constant centralization of mining power. So that's an important distinction talking about how that selfish mining attack is exploited explicitly because of the delay in the propagation of blocks. And that's why some people are so crazy gung-ho about making blocks as small as possible, like Luke Dash Jr. On Twitter, who thinks we should lower the block size and that SegWit increased way too much. And this is now actually more of a concern than it was. I don't think it's a huge concern right now. Block propagation is pretty fast, and as long as you have a huge validation network that rejects any miners who's trying to trick or double spend or anything, you know, it's up to the miners themselves whether or not they want to just go buy a hash that doesn't validate everything and assume blocks are valid, because immediately they run the risk of spending all this hash power, spending tons of capital to mine a block that basically rejects their ability to spend the coins. So if they do that, that's really stupid. That's on them. They are willingly taking that risk, but as long as the network itself of nodes, full nodes, can just reject anything that is not following the consensus rules, well then, you know, let the miners take that risk. It's not really, I don't consider that a huge trade-off. Let's take a quick break right here. I need a stretch break, and I need to get out of this cave for a second. And we'll hit our sponsor, and then we'll jump right back in. Okay, two. Transactions. Quote from the white paper. We define an electronic coin as a chain of digital signatures. Each owner transfers the coin to the next by digitally signing a hash of the previous transaction and the public key of the next owner and adding these to the end of the coin. End quote. Implementation detail. Bitcoin implements a more general version of this system where digital signatures are not used directly, but rather a, quote, deterministic expression is used instead. Just as a signature that matches a known public key can be used to enable a payment, the data that satisfies a known expression can also enable a payment. Generically, the expression that must be satisfied in Bitcoin in order to spend a coin is known as an, quote, encumbrance. Almost all encumbrances in Bitcoin to date require providing at least one signature. So instead of saying, quote, a chain of digital signatures, it is actually more correct to say a chain of encumbrances. So this is just a terminology use, essentially, is that it does not necessarily have to be a digital signature. That's kind of the most standard of standard transactions is I sign with my key and then send it to the next public key of the next owner, and then that chain continues from transaction to transaction. But basically with like multi-sig, with scripting, with all of these things, it's not really necessary that it doesn't have to be a quote-unquote digital signature from a specific private key to transfer Bitcoin to. You might want to transfer it just to a sequence of events that needs to be proven. So instead, you send it to a script hash. That's like the pay-to-script hash that was implemented in Bitcoin. And so because of that, you might want to do something a little bit more complex. You might want to have an open payment channel, and you might have multiple signatures in this agreement that aren't just simply signing, that actually have to fulfill some role or sequence of events that are going on. So it's, in the end, it produces a digital signature, but it's a custom encumbrance. It is simply a stipulation on how that Bitcoin can be spent. And essentially, you could have an open stipulation. You could have an encumbrance that just says the first person who gets this coin or the first person who locks this coin with their public key gets it. And you can just basically spend it out into a complete lack of encumbrances. But it's still a chain. So many people get this just ridiculously wrong. Like every transaction still has to a reference to the previous transaction. Every transaction still has to have 100% proof of ownership that they have met the encumbrance. They're able to sign and release the coins from the previous encumbrance, from the previous public key, whatever it is, script, anything that's used to lock up those coins, or if nothing, if they just broadcast it out to let anybody take it, well, they have to be the first one to get a confirmation to encumber it with their new encumbrance. That word's a little bulky, isn't it? Encumbrance. That's just a weird word. But because of that, like, it's still absolutely 100% a chain. SegWit did not change this at all. There's this stupid idea that it's no longer a chain of signatures. Even though you can just check at Block Explorer, you can chase every transaction back to when it was generated in a Coinbase, that when it was issued as new Bitcoin. But, you know, whatever. 4. Proof of work. Quote, "We implement the proof of work by incrementing a nonce in the block until a value is found that gives the block's hash the required 0 bits. End quote. So a nonce is, for those of you who don't know, it just means a number used only once. And it's a way of changing the hash without actually changing any of the data. So that is what proof of work is. It's a little bit out of the scope of a single episode to go into all of that detail. But just for our references, it's just a number that's completely arbitrary outside of the fact that it allows us to rehash the exact same data and get a different value. That is what proof of work is. Okay, so the implementation detail. So there's a difference in the implementation. Atomback's hashcash implementation requires finding a hash with the required number of leading 0 bits. Bitcoin treats the hash as an integer and requires that it be less than a specified integer, which effectively allows a fractional number of bits to be specified. This is really important because this is something that I heard all the time, and I just didn't understand. When I would look at the difficulty, I was always trying to seek out an answer for this, and it wasn't until I read through Mastering Bitcoin by Andreas Antonopoulos that I finally, the first time, that I finally was like, okay, that's how it works. And so it's not actually, like, each, if you look at the hash of the block, you'll notice there's only, like, I don't know, like, I'm just pulling this out of my ass, but it's like 11 leading zeros or something like that on the hash. And so my immediate thought when everybody says finding a hash is based on finding a specific number of leading zeros, and then you see the hash and you're like 11, like the difficulty adjustment has raised, I don't know, it's every 2,000 blocks, so, you know, we're 500,000 blocks now, so an enormous number of times, 50 per 100,000 blocks, the difficulty has likely raised or has shifted in some way. How do we only have 11 zeros? How can you have, like, isn't the only distinction between 10 zeros and 11 zeros? Granted, I'm looking at something, when you're looking at the hash, you're looking at it in, hex? You're not looking at the actual bits, but if every zero, you're looking at a multiple of 2 every time. So how, if we're just talking about leading zeros, how could we possibly have small adjustments in the difficulty? How do you raise the difficulty 10% as opposed to doubling it, which is what it would require? Well, that's because it's treated as an integer. So you can have the exact same number of leading zeros, but actually still increase the difficulty by making it so you have to move it just one space down. Like it says, it's treated as an integer. You can move it by increments of 1. The difficulty can move very, very small amounts, whereas the idea that it has to be a leading zero, what's the best way? What's an analogy for this? Okay, let's say we're using a 4-digit number, like 1,000, right? And if we were saying that it had to be a difference in the leading zero, then the first leading zero would be a difficulty range all the way from 100 to 999. But because it would be 0999 was the difficulty. Well, it's actually treated like an integer. So the next difficulty adjustment would not be 2 zeros, which would mean from 10 to 99 was the difficulty adjustment, which is a huge jump from 999 to 99. But if it's treated as an integer, you can go 999, 998. And you've got the same number of leading zeros, but you're still lowering the difficulty. So maybe that's a very long explanation, but that's what they mean by the fact that it's not actually leading zero bits, even though that's what people constantly repeat. And you'll see it in explanation after explanation that you're looking for a hash with a certain number of zeros at the beginning, but that's not true. You're looking for an integer that is lower than the number that they actually, that is the difficulty. So that's an important clarification that is actually just wrong in the white paper, because, I mean, it's not quote-unquote wrong, it's just a simplification that does not actually distinguish the reality. I was very happy when I finally figured that out, because I was like, this whole difficulty adjustment does not make any sense if we're just talking about leading zeros. I could tell there was something wrong with that. Thank you, Andreas Antonopoulos and Mastering Bitcoin. That book is amazing. If you want to know and learn everything about digital chain of digital signatures and mining and hashing and all that stuff, that is where you go. You can actually get that on my website through an affiliate link, so I'll get, I don't know, like a nickel or something if you do that, off of cryptoeconomy.life, the Bitcoin Survivors book list. So if you have not gotten your copy of Mastering Bitcoin, what are you doing? Don't you want to know this stuff? How can you not, how can you just not want to know how many leading zeros are needed to adjust the difficulty adjustment? Like, that's the coolest thing ever. Anyway, quote, move on. Proof of work is essentially one CPU, one vote, end quote. This is just an important note. The vote here is not on the rules of the system, but merely on the ordering of the transactions in order to provide assurances that an, quote, electronic coin cannot be easily double spent. This is described in more detail in section 11 of the paper, where it says, quote, we consider the scenario of an attacker trying to generate an alternate chain faster than the honest chain. Even if this is accomplished, it does not throw the system open to arbitrary changes, such as creating value out of thin air or taking money that never belonged to the attacker. Nodes are not going to accept an invalid transaction as payment, and honest nodes will never accept a block containing them. End quote. Really important. I'm glad he put this important note in this, because there are a lot of people who take proof of work as essentially one CPU, one vote at a ridiculous face value and then stop reading the white paper. They just think that means that proof of work is voting on what the rules are. And this is not true. Nodes, you can read it in the code. Nodes don't care what the proof of work is. If it's outside, it is down the list after validating the consensus rules. If it violates any of the consensus rules, then it is not, then it doesn't matter how much proof of work. You can build a machine the size of the sun and proof of work at many thousands, hundreds of thousands of times the capacity of the entire Bitcoin network. But if you try to spend money that you don't have the private key for, it means nothing. You're not voting on the rules. You're voting on whether it's your block that follows the rules or someone else's block that follows the rules that is the consensus of the chain. That is it. You cannot spend money that doesn't exist. You cannot invent new Bitcoin. You cannot take money from other people. None of that is possible. None of the consensus rules are being voted on every block. This is not a democracy. This is an everybody is running the rules, and we're voting on who gets the chance to extend it this next 10 minutes, period. So really important distinction, and I'm glad that that is made. Even though the white paper actually explains it, it's in a completely different section, so it's easy to misinterpret that. Okay, quote, proof of work difficulty is determined by a moving average targeting an average number of blocks per hour, end quote. Implementation detail. A moving average is not used. Instead, every 2016th block has its reported generation time compared to the generation time of an earlier block. and the difference between them is used to calculate the average used for adjustment. Further, the average implemented in Bitcoin targets an average number of blocks per 2 weeks, not per hour, as might be implied by the text. Other implemented rules may further slow adjustments, such as the rule that the adjustment cannot increase block production speed by more than 300% per period, nor slow it by more than 75%. So that's just a clarification on the fact that there are other restrictions on the difficulty adjustment. One being that, you know, if even if, you know, 10 times the hash power dumps onto the network, difficulty cannot go up by more than 300% each time, but periods will come for period. We're not talking about menstrual cycles here, but each difficulty period will come much faster if, you know, obviously if there's 1,000% increase in the difficulty or in the hash power on the network, then you're going to see the next difficulty period come at 1 week or 5 days as opposed to 2 full weeks, because the difficulty can only adjust by 300% rather than 1,000. And then same in the reverse, is that it can only be slowed by 75% on a decrease, which again makes gaming the difficulty adjustment more difficult and difficulty more stable and easier to predict. And also, obviously, the important detail that it's not actually a moving average. This doesn't actually clarify, like what the earlier block is that picked. And I don't actually remember off the top of my head. But it's just basically clarifying that it's not a moving average. They're just comparing a current block to some other block in the past to give a measure that's. This is basically removing any outliers where the timestamp might be completely wrong. And you'll see it. You'll see it regularly. If you're a nerd and you like just watch a block explore on occasion, you'll notice timestamps for a later block might actually have a timestamp earlier than the previous block. So it's like, how the hell does that happen? Well, it's just because the timestamp is not used to order blocks. The hash and the timestamp can be pushed 2 hours ahead or behind. Like, it's not actually, like, super accurate. Like, you know, your clock on your computer can be wrong, period. So that's just an important distinction that is a little trivial, but it's important to point it out. Like, it is technically an error in speak. Number 7, reclaiming disk space. Quote, once the latest transaction in a coin is buried under enough blocks, the spent transactions before it can be discarded to save disk space. End quote. Possible post-publication discovery. Although the Merkle tree structure described in this section can prove a transaction was included in a particular block, there is currently no way in Bitcoin to prove that a transaction has not been spent except to process all subsequent data in the blockchain. This means the method described here cannot be universally used for reclaiming disk space among all nodes, as all new nodes will need to process all transactions. It's basically saying that if the structure does not allow you, it allows one node to prune the data for themselves, but they have to first have the data to prove that it was there before they can do so. So if the entire network attempted to prune that data, we would essentially completely eliminate the ability for new nodes to come on the network and validate for themselves. It immediately becomes a club of, okay, did you join while we still had full nodes, or did you join afterward? Because if you joined afterward, well, you're just trusting that everybody else did it for you in the past, and that ability is now gone. So it's important to recognize that just because it's buried under enough blocks does not mean that you can trust it blatantly. Like, it is, in fact, that you are trusting it because you've lost the ability to validate it if you do not have that actual transaction data to compare it to. And that goes right into the next point on simplified payment verification. Quote, one strategy to protect against this would be to accept alerts from network nodes when they detect an invalid block, prompting the user's software to download the full block and alerted transactions to confirm the inconsistency. End quote. This is an important note. Although software has been produced that implements some parts of this section and calls that Simplified Payment Verification, or SPV, none of these programs currently accepts alerts from network nodes or full validation nodes when invalid blocks have been detected. This has placed Bitcoins in so-called SPV wallets at risk in the past. Now, this is basically just explaining that, and there's multiple times that Satoshi kind of talked about simplified payment verification and that a proof that something was in a block and against the consensus rules, and that basically you wouldn't have to, you could validate without having to have all of that data. But this is essential. This was never worked out. It was kind of an over-optimistic assumption by Satoshi that we were just going to figure this out and there were going to be proofs that we could implement that made it so everyone didn't have to run a fully validating node, and we just don't have that. SPV is a massive security trade-off when we're talking about validation of the rules, and if everybody was running an SPV node and the miners just decided the blocks were going to be 50 megabytes or that, well, you know what, let's just not do this next halving because I really like my current profit margins. So instead of moving down from 12.5 to 6.25 blocks, let's just keep 12.5 indefinitely. None of the SPV nodes would keep that in check. Every SPV node would just blindly say, okay, so there's a valid hash on this block. It's proof of work is still there. Well, all right, let's keep running with it. They wouldn't even check. They wouldn't see that there was 12.5 Bitcoin produced instead of 6.25, and they wouldn't care. They would just be lemmings following whoever's got the biggest computer. It would be biggest CPU rules overall. So SPV cannot serve that role. And this is an important distinction because I think Satoshi just hoped that that was going to be the case at some point. And also there's no alert network, like alerts on the network from full nodes. And I think that kind of makes sense too. It's just kind of you immediately go into a trusted relationship because you're still depending on somebody else to do the work for you. So I think it's kind of redundant and then kind of implements like a real problem of like an attack vector is that if you can cheat the alerts, because if the SPV is not doing it, then it is not actually checking the work. Well, then the SPV is just blindly listening to the alerts it's getting from other nodes. So I'd see that as like a security problem as opposed to a benefit. Okay, number 10, privacy. Quote, some linking is still unavoidable with multi-input transactions, which necessarily reveal that their inputs were owned by the same owner, end quote. Or this is from the white paper again. That's what the quotes are. Post-publication invention. The revelation of a common owner for different inputs is not necessary if owners often mix their inputs with inputs belonging to other owners. This is something that we're talking about, like CoinJoin or any kind of aggregation of inputs and outputs, etc. So, for example, there's no public difference between Alice and Bob each contributing one of their inputs towards paying Charlie and Dan than there is between just Alice contributing two of her inputs towards paying Charlie and Dan. This technique is known today as CoinJoin, and software implementing it has been in use since 2015. And there's actually a number of other like implementations and variations on this, like TumbleBit, CoinJoin, obviously. And then there's just kind of general aggregation that makes, like if you can aggregate signatures, like Schnorr signatures, which obviously is not possible yet, but there's just a BIP for it. These are many different things that basically make that the fact that you can just link multi-input transactions and assume that all those inputs are by the same owner, it basically just breaks that most basic assumption. Okay, and number 11, calculations. And this is our last one, so we're here. Quote, the receiver generates a new key pair and gives the public key to the sender shortly before signing. This prevents the sender from preparing a chain of blocks ahead of time by working on it continuously until he is lucky enough to get far enough ahead, then executing the transaction at that moment, end quote. Post-publication discovery. Nothing about the receiver generating a public key shortly before the sender signs a transaction prevents the spender from preparing a chain of blocks ahead of time. Early Bitcoin user Hal Finney discovered this attack and described it. Quote from Hal. Suppose the attacker is generating blocks occasionally. In each block he generates, he includes a transfer from address A to address B, both of which he controls. To cheat you, when he generates a block, he doesn't broadcast it. Instead, he runs down to your store and makes a payment to your address C with his address A. You wait a few seconds, don't hear anything, and transfer the goods. He broadcasts his block now, and his transaction will take precedence over yours. End quote. The attack works for any number of confirmations and is sometimes named the Finney attack. So this was basically the this was kind of explaining the difference between a transaction with no confirmations, and it's basically exposing the fact that a unconfirmed transaction is not a secure transaction, and the fact that double spends can still happen if you've got a longer chain or a block with a transaction in it that negates something that's in the mempool or has just been broadcast. So he by the attacker having a block, he just like waits until he has a block to actually make the transaction. Then he can put his own transaction in a block that empties his address to another address that is his, and then just wait. Like, and as soon as he has that block, as soon as he's produced it, he can be like, okay, go, and I'm going to go up to the register, and now I'm going to buy this thing, and I'm going to send a payment to the actual store owner's address, which will be unconfirmed, which will just immediately enter the mempool and now need a confirmation. And the store owner sees the transaction. They're like, okay, everything's good. Here's your steak or your coffee, whatever it is that you're buying from me. And now the attacker walks out but broadcasts his block. The fact that he received the public key to send it to just at the time of transacting does not take the which transaction came first does not take precedence. Which transaction makes it into a block first? It is the confirmation that and by that same nature, the confirmations with the most proof of work, so also the longest or most worked chain, for that matter. So it was basically realizing that, and Finney described, and you can actually read the, he's got a link to the BitcoinTalk.org forum, so you can read this whole thing. I went through about, looks like about half of it until they were just reiterating, you know, the same points over and over and trying to work out the details. But it's a good little discussion. It's got, you know, Garzik and Gavin and Cassius and Thamos and Hal Finney and the whole thing. So you can go and kind of just read that discussion about when they were realizing and people were working out the details of security and a transaction with confirmations and how you could actually withhold a block from the network and use it to essentially double spin something that... that was waiting to be included into a block. So that's a really important distinction. That was just something that Satoshi did not see ahead of time. He thought that there was that you could essentially make sure that like you could essentially watch the network and just make sure that you got a transaction to you first and then the other one, and then you just basically don't have to worry. But that just simply was not the case. There is an attack that could technically be easily executed by somebody with at least some hash power that could trick you into thinking you had received a transaction and then basically renege on that deal. All right, and that's basically, that's the whole list. That was, I hope some of that, like, either taught you something or kind of extended what you knew about some of these things. Probably the biggest thing in this whole list, I will scan stuff like this ever so often, and this has just been put in like a list of things that I use as references and stuff. And I'm not sure when I first bumped into this. I just found it in my list and looked at it again. It was last updated on January 6, 2019. So, but there's a couple of important distinctions that I think are really important to consider. I think the most proof of work chain versus the longest chain was kind of a, it seems almost semantic, but it's an important consensus thing, because it is not, it's about the most proof of work. It's not about like what your block height is. And then the difference between mining nodes and validating nodes, the fact that those two roles divorced very quickly on the network because of the high cost and specialized hardware in no time at all required to be an efficient miner, somebody who's actually can be profitable. And the fact that miners don't have to validate to mine, that you can produce a hash on a piece of paper. You know, like, you're not going to get anywhere with it. You're not going to make any profit. But you can do that. You know, like, you don't have to have any idea of what the previous block is, what data is in it, what transactions are in it, or what the consensus rules are. All you need to do to extend the chain is have the previous hash of the block, the block header. And some miners do that because having to download and validate is a time cost. It is a computational cost. So if it takes 7 seconds for your computer to do that, for your machine to validate the previous block, that is 7 seconds in which a bigger miner, or just somebody who is only accepting the hash and not caring about the validation, that's 7 seconds worth of advantage that they have over you. So miners typically don't validate first. Even the miners that do validate start working on the block regardless of validation, and then they do the validation later to make sure that they are not falling behind the rest of the network or larger miners on the network. And that's a really important distinction because, you know, with this whole week is about kind of nodes and some of those problems and the changes in how we're thinking about Bitcoin. And I think that will be an important piece to take later on in our continued discussion this week about validation and what is Bitcoin and what is not. Okay, so I think that pretty much covers it all. His disclaimer at the end, which I already said at the beginning. Again, this is a collection by David Harding. If you are not following him, he's done a lot of great stuff. His whole GitHub just has tons of little tidbits like these that are great. I don't remember exactly how many of these that he has, but he collects information and stuff. There's a lot to go exploring on this. If you want to take a little rabbit hole dive on to GitHub for some important data. But his disclaimer is that the author of this document was not the first person to identify any of the problems described here. He's merely collected them into a single document. So a thank you for him doing that work for us so that we can kind of go through this and see, you know, some of the distinctions between how we thought Bitcoin was going to be or what roles were supposed to be or essentially envisioned in Bitcoin that just didn't work out. That when the network went live, which again, the white paper was 2 months and some change before the network was even a network. You know, you can't just... like inevitably you're going to get something wrong. Like you've not seen the thing in action. You know, there's not even a test net. Like we get wrong about things on test net that have already been implemented and then we find out they don't work. So obviously the white paper can't know everything. The white paper is just a best guess of Satoshi on what he was building, its security and implementation details and what it all means, which was pretty brilliant. And obviously what he created was unbelievably revolutionary. It's a brilliant design, but there's tons of stuff in the white paper there's tons of stuff in the implementation and in the actual network that is not in the white paper. We talked about this a couple of times. There's no 21 million limit in the white paper. A bunch of little details like that that are critical to the Bitcoin network, to the consensus rules that it's not stipulated in the white paper. And then obviously there are some weird clarifications and terminology that does not quite work, and then changes to Bitcoin itself that had to come later that are not exactly in line. So the white paper is not some holy document that it's an explanation of what it is. Every explanation is incomplete. Every explanation is going to have mild errors, or it might need some sort of clarification. So it's just important to know that, that, you know, we're not religious about this thing. This is a tool, and we need to make, we need to build to make this tool as good at doing what makes the tool revolutionary as we can possibly accomplish. So with that, this will be a lead in to further episodes this week. So don't miss them. I hope you learned something today. And do not forget to subscribe. If you're looking for Harding, David Harding on Twitter, his tag is actually Harding without vowels. So it's like H-R-D-N-G. That's his Twitter tag. You should definitely be following him. Really smart guy, knows his stuff, and always has some good points. And he occasionally is writing stuff about Bitcoin on a couple of different platforms. So really good resource to have there. And a thank you for him for a thank you to him for doing this. And also, you can follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy. This is The Crypto Economy Project or Crypto Economy Podcast. My project to bring all of the Bitcoin, best Bitcoin content and education into audio so that you can listen and learn. And the task of trying to understand Bitcoin is massive. It feels insurmountable. I'm trying to condense it down and give you all the most fun and enlightening perspectives on this crazy thing we call Bitcoin and the crypto economy. All right. So don't forget to follow me on Twitter. And if you would like to support the show, the two things that you can do is A, just share it out with everybody that you know, the other people that you know who want to learn this stuff and understand Bitcoin and get it from all of these, the economic, the political, the philosophical perspectives, and understand what the difference between a validating node and a miner is. This is where you send them. So share this out with everybody you know. And then lastly, this show definitely runs predominantly on donations. So if anybody would like to support the show, you can go to cryptoeconomy.life, or you can give me I got a tip in me.me jar, both on the website and then just on my Twitter. So if you would like to support the show, and thank you. There's a number of people who've given me like a couple of $5 donations and a $10 donations. Thank you guys so much for doing that. And if you would like to contribute and help make this thing sustainable, that would be a wonderful help. Thank you so much. And until next time, we will continue our discussions about what Bitcoin is and how the network defines that for the rest of the week. I will catch you guys tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, guys. We'll be right back.